Panel two this afternoon takes the perspective of the past little while, not rigidly defined, but up to the present. What does it look like in the present era, middle of the 20-teens, from the viewpoint of implementing ethics and values regimes in the public service? And our panel here is Andrew Hayes, who's active now at the Office of the Auditor General. He'll introduce the topic and give a bit of perspective from the Auditor General office. And then we're going to hear from Andrew Troisch, who will talk about the senior leadership perspective, and Fraser, who will talk from the perspective of the operations of a large and important Office of Values and Ethics. And Ian Braun will talk about some of the cracks in the system as experienced by people who have serious issues and want to bring them to the kind of attention that they need to have. And so here we have Andrew Hayes, who will be talking just from his own notes, and Andrew, followed by Andrew Troisch, and then we'll have PowerPoint presentations as well as the verbal presentation from Anne and Ian after that. Thank you, Andrew.
Thank you, Robert, for the introduction. I was going to say a couple of words about the esteemed panelists that we have here with us. I feel fairly, I wouldn't say insecure, but I, as I sit here with my esteemed colleagues, Andrew Troisch, who is the Commissioner of CRA and the Chief Executive Officer, speaking from a leadership perspective, Anne, who I'm sure everyone would agree is recognized amongst her colleagues as an expert and a resource for everyone, and Ian, who has personal experience that he's going to bring to the table from what I will say is a very important aspect of the ethics and accountability regime. I can't imagine a better, more diverse panel than what we have. So I'll start off with a bit of commentary from the perspective of the Office of the Auditor General. And I think I should probably preface by saying the comments that I make are my own, and I do not intend to speak on behalf of the Auditor General. I guess I'm going to also try to weave in some of the very interesting themes that we heard about this morning. Because I think that in many ways the Tate Report and some of the reports of the Auditor General throughout the last 25 or so years dovetail well together. We heard from Mr. Heintzman about the focus of a strong foundation, and one of those focal points was the institutional rather than the individual. As I go through some of the audit reports, you'll see that there are some reports that have been focused on the institutional, but as you get to the upper end of the public service and you find ethical or accountability challenges, it is difficult to separate the institutional and the individual at some of those levels. So beginning in the mid-90s, there was an Auditor General report in 1995 that was called Ethics and Fraud Awareness in Government. That report was prepared by then Auditor General Denis Desautels, who I would say I never had the privilege of working with Mr. Desautels, but he has a lasting legacy of integrity in our office. He stated that Canadians were concerned about integrity in government, and they have the right to expect the highest ethical standards in their governments. He also noted that if Canadians do not trust their governments to act ethically, governments will find that their actions have less and less legitimacy and effectiveness. Auditor General Desautels again audited values and ethics in the public sector in an audit that was provided to Parliament in October 2000. In that report, he recommended that government reinforce leadership for promoting ethical conduct. And of course, that was a theme we heard a lot this morning. That they reinvigorate an extensive dialogue on values and ethics that emphasizes the primacy of the principles of respect for law, the public interest, and public service as a public trust. Another recommendation was to develop a statement of values and ethics for the public sector and for each federal entity. Finally, he recommended that guidance be provided for ethical decision making and to develop a recourse mechanism to allow the voicing of ethical concerns with appropriate protection for all concerned. These were important recommendations, by no means exhaustive, but these were important recommendations at that time that as we move through the 2000s, we see come through in legislation and in other actions by government. So that was 2000. A few years later, getting into some of the individual, we had a couple of audits that the Auditor General, then Sheila Fraser, was called upon to examine. In September 2003, Ms. Fraser delivered an audit report on the Office of the Privacy Commissioner. In her report, she described that work environment as a, quote, reign of terror, where the Privacy Commissioner had humiliated staff, made inappropriate comments, and engaged in verbal abuse that she said was socially unacceptable in either Canada in general or in the public service in particular. Shortly after that report, two months actually after that report, the Auditor General delivered her reports, her three reports, that became the centerpiece of the sponsorship inquiry by Justice Gomery. Those three reports were on the sponsorship program, public opinion research, and advertising activities. And the Auditor General found blatant disregard of rules in all three of those in those audits. I think that it can be argued, my personal opinion here, but I think it can be argued that those reports were seminal in many ways in terms of both the management of government-wide matters like that, and also that they influenced the development of the Federal Accountability Act and the Public Servants Disclosure Protection Act. It would be nice to say that after the public attention of the Gomery inquiry and the public scrutiny of the ethics and integrity of those involved, we would be less likely to encounter such situations, but unfortunately that wasn't the case. The Auditor General delivered a report on the Correctional Investigator in 2006 and found that that head of an organization committed serious abuses and wrongdoing, some of which resulted in substantial personal gain. The Auditor General recommended that the Privy Council Office ensure that it appropriately advises and trains full-time governor and council appointees about their expected standards of conduct as holders of public office. In 2010, the Auditor General completed an audit of the Public Sector Integrity Commissioner. Perhaps the most unfortunate feature of the findings in that report, from my perspective, is that it had the same flavor as the 2003 report on the Privacy Commissioner. With respect to the Public Sector Integrity Commissioner, the Auditor General concluded, and I'll read a couple of passages here, the allegations made by complainants concerning the Commissioner's inappropriate conduct and interactions with PSIC staff, retaliatory actions by the Commissioner, and the failure by the Commissioner to properly perform her mandated functions were founded. The Auditor General also stated, "We are of the view that the Commissioner's conduct and actions were inconsistent with the spirit of the PSDPA, the same act from which she obtains her mandate. Further, the Values and Ethics Code for the Public Service states that, quote, public servants shall act at all times in a manner that will bear the closest public scrutiny, an obligation that is not fully discharged by simply acting within the law." The Auditor General expressed her view that the Commissioner's behavior and actions do not pass the test of public scrutiny and are inappropriate and unacceptable for a public servant, most notably for an agent of Parliament, specifically charged with the responsibility of upholding integrity in the public sector and protecting public servants from reprisal. Those are as damning words as Auditor General Fraser would use. Moving to recent reports, in 2015, Auditor General Michael Ferguson, who is the current Auditor General, delivered a report on senators' expenses to the Senate of Canada. This audit was requested by the Senate in response to some expense concerns that had already come to light. At the time where the office was asked to come in, there were four senators that were facing public scrutiny over their spending. and some of those cases would ultimately lead to charges. While the negative findings from the Auditor General's report have occupied the media spotlight, I think that it's worth noting that the audit did not find problems with the expenses incurred by most senators, by almost 70 senators. The audit report made recommendations to help improve transparency, accountability, and oversight, and it provided the Senate, in my view, with an opportunity to move forward. Perhaps that's the value of audit in the grand scheme of things. Finally, I guess I should mention that in 2017, in May 2017, the Auditor General returned to the public service values and ethics on a macro level in a report on managing fraud risk. The Auditor General concluded that federal organizations were not appropriately managing all the fraud risks, but we did in that report note a number of good practices. And there is some positive commentary in that report on values and ethics in the public sector. We also made recommendations that I think are important. It emphasized the need for mandatory training in values and ethics. I suppose that it is likely that we'll see future audits that will address values and ethics in the public service. My hope is that the significance of the issues that we find as an office will never be as concerning as those that we found in the sponsorship audits. And likewise, that we won't see these kinds of issues with heads of agencies who, as Sheila Fraser put it, had a reign of terror. The following, I guess I would end with a statement from the Tate Report, which I've always found to be very instructive. The most important defining factor for the role and values of the Public Service of Canada is its democratic mission and public trust, helping ministers under law and constitution to serve the common good. In my view, there's no better way of explaining what a public servant is supposed to do than that. So with that in mind, I guess I've set it up for Andrew here. We've heard about leadership and the importance in setting that tone. Andrew had the privilege of leading organizations in the public service, and I'm sure that your comments will be instructive and helpful for us all. Thank you, Andrew.
Thank you, Brother Andrew. First, thank you for allowing me to be a part of an event that commemorates the career and the legacy of John Tate. And having heard through the day from Ralph Heinzman and Scott Searson, John Tate is with us still. This invitation did cause me to reread the 1996 report, A Strong Foundation, which is online, and I'm glad I did so. And I recalled from the report that the purpose of the report in its time was to rediscover the basic values of the public service, to recommit and to act. And this, if I was still gainfully employed, would no doubt have occasioned the same of me. And the report calls for dialogue and discussion, and I will open with that and close with that. That's what we're doing today. That's what he called for. And I think when we look at the balance between codes and rules and training and awareness and leadership, the central point of that, as you said, Ralph, earlier today, is constant dialogue and discussion. And today's conference is part of that. Now, I have no special expertise in the subject, unlike everyone else you've heard from, and I certainly don't speak from any higher moral plane. But I think I was asked, given the years of time that I spent in the Federal Public Service, culminating in the Canada Revenue Agency, and SIN number 732-475-690, your tax return is overdue. Now, you know that the CRA, I'll just briefly mention, it collects taxes for both federal and provincial governments, except Quebec, and it also administers benefit programs, and it has 40,000 employees, so it certainly has its challenges with values and ethics, as did my previous employer, Public Works, managing major procurement as well as real property transactions. Rereading the Tate report, it stands the test of time. It reminds us of fundamental values like the merit principle, the nonpartisan nature of the public service, truth to power, fearless advice, loyal implementation. These were true when I joined government 35 years ago. They're preached today, as they should be. And we have a role to always be re-articulating these values and passing them on to the next generation. So the Tate Report remains relevant today as it was in 1996. But I'm going to focus my remarks on what has changed in the past 20 years. That's 20 years. And if you look back and you look around, you see a lot that's changed. So I'm now going to be a very cheap paperback historian. Look at our society. It's far more pluralist. Immigration has placed an increasing role, not only in numbers, but people are coming from very different societies, bringing a different mix of culture, religion, language, values, and beliefs into the Canadian polity. The family has changed. Churches are in retreat against secularism. Marriage is far from the expected social norm. And there are many different forms of family that we now recognize. The role of women has changed, and for the good. Gender roles are changing. Witness the rise of the LGBT movement, now mainstream. Consider changes in technology and how they reshape business, the workplace, family life, leisure, and governments as well. Everyone knows business has gone global. I mean, your manufacturers rely on global supply changes. There are other kinds of change. Bioengineering, not an area I have any expertise in, but giving rise to whole new ethical and moral questions that previous generations never had to confront. New types of global enterprises. The largest are Amazon, Apple, Facebook, Google. These social media giants, their value is in their data, not in the minerals that they mine. A whole new economy called the sharing economy, Airbnb, Uber, many others will follow, threatening conventional sectors. New technologies that turn traditional industries into dinosaurs and whole cities and regions into rust belts. The internet now connects a majority of the billions of people around the planet, gives them instant access to information anywhere, anytime. A smartphone puts in your pocket a computer, a camera, a phone, a typewriter, a fax machine, a data bank, and a television. And again, all new challenges to values and ethics that were unforeseen when I entered government. I'm going to focus on three areas. First, democratic values. The world of politics is powerfully shaped by and responds to the media. It's well documented that conventional print media are under extreme duress, ad revenues falling, decliners leaving, as is conventional network television. People get their information from social media. The polity, as a result, is fragmented and fractured and seemingly full of angry, yelling voices. Traditional media norms of objectivity and fairness and verified facts, these are not the hallmarks of social media. And time has changed. News and analysis are replaced by infotainment and celebrity opinion. The news cycle is 24/7. Politicians are hounded for immediate reaction. And public service is hard-pressed to keep pace. Parliament isn't what it once was. Most political leaders find it more important to hit the road in settings far beyond the parliamentary precinct. Tell me, can you think of a truly important debate that happened in Parliament recently? Can you remember a seminal parliamentary committee report in recent years? The journalists that cover Parliament, which was the highest calling of a journalist in the past, now it's down to a dwindling few. Allegiance to political parties has declined. There are fewer true believers, more instant members that sign up just to advance a leadership campaign. It's far more likely that an outsider with a motivated base can capture a nomination. parties mean less. The Republican Party, to take an obvious example, is now the Trump Party. Post-Watergate, the media has become more skeptical of elites and institutions. Respect for authority has declined worldwide. The media is far more likely to dig deep into the public service to find what went wrong and who to fault. Calls for unfettered access to information and data have increased. The anonymity of the public service is falling away. Many ministers don't feel they should take the blame for an error or oversight in administration that they had no role in. But paradoxically, many ministers are also very uneasy with public servants taking the public limelight and leaving them in the shadows. Ministers are very hard-pressed to stay on top of issues that move with the speed of a tweet, and even harder for public servants to keep pace. Our traditional values of analysis and due deliberance, follow the chain of authority, double check, triple check, doesn't move that quickly. Management of data is a big issue now. Service delivery is much improved by moving from paper to online service. Tax return can be processed, a payment issued in mere seconds, nanoseconds, in fact. But big data also brings new and profound concerns over privacy and security. We have one parliamentary agent that acts the advocate for access to information. We have another that safeguards privacy. But in the public sector, we have to serve both masters. And these issues are far more top of mind and concerning today than they were 20 years ago. In the Tate report, there's a strong presumption that Canadian values, as reflected in the legal foundation of the Constitution, the Charter, were a solid bedrock. But as I look out and around, and I look at the Trump presidency, I look at the Brexit movement in the United Kingdom, I feel worried. The march towards democracy has lost its forward momentum, even suffered reversals in many countries. We're less hopeful today than a decade ago than we were about China. We're far more worried about Russia. Are we so sure or so smug that nothing can happen here? In summary, we should be more concerned about democratic values looking outward from 2018. A populist Canadian Prime Minister with a majority in Parliament would face fewer checks and balances than President Trump. I think that's an undeniable fact, reality of our system. Let me turn to a second area, people values or employment values, as the Tate Report called them. The Tate Report, as noted, was very much focused on a 1990s preoccupation, downsizing, and the realization that a public servant didn't necessarily have a job for life. Well, there's been two or three waves since then, so I think we've well learned that lesson. But thanks in part to the Tate Report, we now have the benefit of triennial, I believe, public sector surveys. And they've told us a lot about the views and the morale of public servants. They tell us that there's a lot of pride and commitment in public servants, and it's hard to erode. But they also tell us that public servants feel overworked, underappreciated, and far worse, far too many feel harassed or discriminated against in the workplace. Policies, awareness and training, recourse mechanisms have all been put in place, but there are still many who do not know how to lodge a complaint, or they lack confidence that the mechanism will result in justice, or they fear retribution. So there's still more work to be done. Thankfully, the clerk does take this seriously and is providing leadership. I must say, I feel some guilt in this grounds because I remember in the early years of my career seeing this kind of behavior in the work maze, and my culpability was staying silent. And I think that's probably often the case in some of the ethical things. It's those who know or should know and haven't turned over the rock or haven't spoken up. The Me Too movement shows the role of women in the workplace is far from ideal if we thought we were at the success line. And we would be wrong to think this is an issue for the U.S. entertainment industry alone. Also, not part of the Tate report are the major changes in the demographics we've seen in the public service as we move to advance employment equity for women, visible minorities, people with disabilities, and indigenous peoples. We've made a lot of progress in over the last 20 years, in some with some categories more than others, but there's still a ways to go. And as now most recently recognized, we've been woefully blind to the serious and multiple challenges facing Indigenous people. And now we're only beginning to look beyond the prescribed employment equity categories. It's to our shame that we now recognize the discrimination against our gay and lesbian employees, and their voices are only now being heard and supported in the public service. The final demographic challenge is aging. The fact that as the baby boomers move into retirement, a whole new generation will need to be recruited in record numbers, and they bring different values which we will have to reconcile, and that's a healthy thing. Finally, I'll close with rules old and new. This part of the Tate report is remarkably prescient and quite current, I thought. Unfortunately, Ralph, you actually covered the ground that I had in my remarks, so I'll do it briefly. But this was quite a foresight by Tate and colleagues to talk about the conflict between the old and the new. And it's not between right and wrong. It's between trying to find the right equilibrium or balance and judgments between these two. So, for example, the conflict between the rules, now we would say the web of rules, and the new management, and new, of course, means, I don't know, 30 years, Ralph, the new management focus on results. And this is important because the Trudeau government has a serious focus on results, a new focus, Ralph. Similarly, the conflict between innovation and risk-taking on the one hand, also very much favored in public service reform, versus haloed public service tradition of prudence, probity, you know, those sisters from Jane, and due diligence. These are very live, very real issues. And if you're a leader and you go to a town hall, I guarantee you will be asked to help reconcile these for your employees. There's no simple answers to these. It's not a binary choice. It's obviously wrong to discard the rule book in pursuit of results, but we can and we must weed the thicket of useless rules that hamstring the effectiveness of the public service. Similarly, the tolerance for risk in the public sector will always be lower than the private sector. Private investors can gamble with their money. It's their money. By contrast, we always need to be good stewards of public dollars. But we need to take calculated and smart risk. So I'm a big advocate of running experiments in the public service as a way of managing risk in a way that failure is acceptable. And we've had some success with that. I'll just close my remarks by saying, at Canada Revenue Agency, before the Public Works, if I reflect on my time with my management and in my leadership town halls, I now recognize how much time was spent on what were basically values and ethical dilemmas facing our organizations. I was not there as a subject matter expert. I was not there to help them process the tax return. At Public Works, real issues about contracting, fairness in procurement that were very important. And at the Canada Revenue Agency, the privacy of taxpayer information, post-employment, the appropriate dealing with stakeholders where you're consulting and involving and getting counsel from outside, but not shady dealings. Social media, about which there's almost very little rules and norms yet. These are things we spent hours on. And so dialogue and discourse and discussion, the The concluding remark I have, someone told me many years ago, in dealing with difficult ethical decisions, bad things don't happen in the open air. Bad things don't happen when they're subject to the sunlight. When something bad is happening, it tends to be people cloister by themselves, and that's a real clue. And it's the way you feel about it too. If you're quite prepared to talk about it and engage others, you'll probably be all right. But if things are being concealed, if they're being secreted, it's probably a warning sign. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Andrew. So some of your last comments focused on the web of rules and what people have to engage in their everyday life. It reminds me of something that Ms. Dawson said, where everyone has blind spots and even good people can find themselves in trouble. Our next speaker might be able to help us navigate through some of that trouble from the operational perspective. Anne is at the back, and I think Robert is going to handle the presentation up on the screen. Anne, are you ready to go?
Oh my gosh, yes. And thank you for accommodating me in this way. Maybe it's part of that aging population of public servants. I guess I'm one of those, but I just can't make it down the staircase. Have you got the changer for it? Because I'm going to try to go quite quickly through my slides. It's not my intention to focus on every one of them, but they provide information for you. And I think I will bring a little bit of a different perspective, because I'm actually going to go into our organization and I'm going to describe for you a little bit the values and ethics program we have within the Canadian Food Inspection Agency and how it actually emanated from the TAPE report. And in fact, there were a number of people, Scott Serson, for example. Oh, is it not close enough? Now I feel like a radio announcer. I'm going to start with this one, because if I look at our values and ethics program now and the way we describe it to our employees or we discuss it, it is about creating an ethical organizational culture. It's not just focusing on the organizational culture itself, but on what it means to be an ethical organizational culture, where the emphasis is really placed on the values of the organization. And in our case, we have internal values, plus we have the values and ethics code for the public sector. And an ethical organization actually makes doing what is right a priority. And what is critical there, though, is that everyone, from the deputy head on down throughout the organization, gets what the doing what right part is, like what right actually means within the organization. And the reason we focus on being an ethical organization is because of the benefits that accrue from being one. I mean, if you look at this slide here, it's just a drop list of some of the things that have been shown to be the strengths of an ethical organization. And this doesn't matter whether you're a federal, you're a government organization, whether you're a private sector organization at all. These are the benefits that accrue to you. And it includes the stronger public image you have, the better relations with your stakeholders, your partners, clients, whatever you call them. And I drop down to that second last bullet, where it talks about, in an ethical organization, you have this increased awareness and understanding of the ethical problems within the organization, because bottom line is, employees are willing to speak up. They trust the leaders of their organization. They trust they will be treated appropriately if they come forward and report something. But often what resonates more with people is when you talk about the challenges or consequences of not focusing on your ethical culture. And if you look at it here, you have this loss of internal trust. Employees will not trust you as an organization. You have the loss of public trust in your organization. But even down to the adverse impacts it has on the health and emotional well-being of an employee. I mean, this is Health and Wellness Week. This is Mental Health Week in the Federal Public Service and in the larger community. And we tend to focus on health and wellness. We use those terminologies. We talk about making sure that we're addressing sexual harassment, other harassment, bullying issues within the federal public service specifically, and as we should be. But if we were focused on our ethical culture, if we strengthen it to a point where we truly have ethical cultures within our organizations, these things will take care of themselves. In an ethical culture, there is a focus on the health and well-being of all employees. And if you don't have an ethical culture, as I like to say to people, you're not going to have a high-performing organization. So I think for myself personally, as an ethics practitioner who still is in the public sector, I would really like to see us talk more about ethical organizational cultures and the power that they have for us as organizations. Within my organization, we focused on a few key initiatives. I did the top 10 at one point. I've added a couple of others just recently. And you'll notice, I mean, yes, we talk about the fact that you need your statement of values. You also need your rules. There's no doubt about that. That was mentioned this morning. They go hand in hand, actually. They're not mutually exclusive. You have your values and ethics training, but also awareness building. And ongoing ethical dialogue is there as well. Plus, having those internal mechanisms where employees know where they can go to report wrongdoing. And they have to be effective mechanisms that they go to. They have to be well-resourced. If you're encouraging your employees to speak up, you have to be prepared for them doing that. But what I'm going to focus on is our strategy, because all those other components on that slide fall in our values and ethics strategy. And I've always said to people, you know, what is the raison d'etre of your program? What is your strategy? Why do you have a V&E program? Surely you know it's the right thing to do, but surely to goodness you don't just have one because you were told to have one. You actually get why a V&E program is so critical to your organization, and you establish it appropriately. So our strategy, we titled it, and this strategy actually was first drafted in 2007, and it was approved in 2008, and we've done an update of it in 2015. But we called it CFIA's Values and Ethics Strategy, a Framework for Ethical Decision Making. And the whole concept behind the strategy was to create and maintain a values-based or ethical organization. So we have been using that terminology since then. The overarching goal of our strategy was to hardwire, and you'll notice I have that in quotations, and I will explain where I got the expression hardwire when I drafted the strategy. But it's basically, values and ethics should be an integral part of everything you do. And I'm going to talk about the challenge I have with how math is now, and the fact that values and ethics is now tucked under people management as opposed to being an umbrella or a foundational piece within sort of the management accountability framework within the federal public service. But what you want to do is you want to hardwire a consideration of your values and ethics into all aspects of your business. One of our key objectives from the strategy right from the beginning is to support and help good people do the right thing. We use the term, I liked it this morning though, this concept of not only knowing what the right thing to do, but I have it here, what was it? The concept of what is the right thing to do, critical, but what is the right thing to be, also critical. And now I'm trying to think of how we could work word sets like that into our own strategy. But basically, we look at the fact that we have 6,000 plus employees walking through the front door every day, and we know they want to do the right thing. We know they know the importance of the work we do. But we have to provide them with the tools and with an understanding of what the right thing is within the organization. I'm not going to go into every slide with respect to our V&E strategy. This is the type of information that's contained within the strategy. From the objectives, from all the roles, from the president, we have a deputy head, a president, through to the frontline employees, the tools that are available to them, as well as the resources that are available to them, are all contained within the values and ethics strategy. And so what our strategy does, it's truly a way to ensure that the CFIA's values and public sector values as well are actually embedded in and embodied by our organization. And when we do training, we talk to employees about the fact that they are the organization. When we talk about organizational culture, when we talk about an organization, if you don't have people, you don't have an organization. So we're talking about the values being embedded in them. They make their decisions according to the values of the organization. Embodied by them means they behave according to them. And that's really key. Therefore, they have to understand them, and they have to understand our expectations with respect to their behaviors. But basically, sorry, there. Yes, please, the next slide. I think this is my big, there. We'll go over that. There's the vision of our strategy. The strategy actually has a vision, but I'll move on from that. These are the elements of the strategy contained within it. They fall under a number of different headings. On the next slide, you're going to see that most of the elements of the strategy fall under management excellence. And I'm going to point out the fact that we talk about the need to do ethical risk profiles, we talk about ethical climate surveys, we talk about providing guidance for having a dialogue with employees and making ethical decisions. But I'm not, every one of these, we talk about what the V&E component of it is. But that's our strategy. But what was the foundation of our strategy? This is it. And I was talking to Mr. Heintzman this morning because in 2006, I was actually asked, I had worked on the development of our values within the organization. I was a member of the science branch at the time. And then they came to me in the fall of 2006 and said, Anne, we want you to develop and implement a V&E program. They didn't talk about strategy at the time, but a V&E program within CFI. And I said, okay, what does that mean? And bottom line is, and it's a challenge even today, there is no manual, V&E 101, for what a values and ethics program should look like within the federal public service. But I had been reading an article. I had read this. I had this article, and it was written actually by this gentleman. You may know him. His name was Ralph Heintzman. And basically, it had come out in the government executive in the spring of 2006, I believe. And he had an article, and there was this diagram. This actual diagram was in the article. And I had read it and thought, oh, okay, so those are the components that make a values and ethics program within the federal public service. Because he had had these, this was his diagram, he had the risk drivers up. I added wording like, where most efforts are focused, which is on the rules and the standards and recourse, and where we needed to focus was on leadership, people, and organizational culture. But this was his diagram. And what came along with that diagram, and I'll just show you on the next slide, was an actual definition, or what was actually expected when he talked about leadership in the context of values and ethics. He talked about values and ethics leaders establishing clear standards, building and reinforcing a strong V&E culture. Things like assessing and managing areas of the organization at high risk for ethical breaches. It's why we do ethical risk profiles, because how do you know that unless you do the proper look into your organization? Establishing monitoring and control. I'm not going to go through all of it, but there it was, all laid out, all the different elements that were required of us became part of the values and ethics program that we currently have within the Canadian Food Inspection Agency. And the next slide is just the other two drivers, standards and recourse, risk assessment and controls. So where you saw that sort of top 10, it's now 12 item list earlier, the kinds of key initiatives and mechanisms we're working on, this is where they came from. Also at the time, and it's a bit of a shame, and I mentioned it earlier, we have the Management Accountability Framework. This stuff all, by the way, all comes from how Mr. Heintzman himself looked at the Tate report, what Tate was recommending, flowed out into here are the drivers that will give you a high-performing V&E organization within the federal public service. MAF at the time, too, the Management Accountability Framework, which flowed out of the Tate report as well, actually had values and ethics as a key component of it. And as I said, values and ethics is now tucked under people management. And I think, quite honestly, as a public servant who will retire in a couple of years, but bottom line is, I think that was a huge mistake. That was a huge mistake that the Federal Public Service made. Because bottom line is, values and ethics, it either underpins everything or it's the umbrella over top of everything. And bottom line is, we tucked it under people management. It was very prescriptive. In 2006, it talked about a lot of stuff that we were expected to do, and that's all disappeared, really. And so you don't get, I think it was Ralph Heinzman who said one of the things that Tate had said is give Treasury Board the power to give the direction, and we've moved away from that. And I really believe when we think of the different types of people who end up at the tops of our organization, I think we need to be a tad more prescriptive in what we tell them they need to be doing. They can adapt it to their organizations and the type of business they do, but they need to be told, you know, guys, this is what you need within your organization. So then we also built ours because Ralph Heinzman in his article talked about the fact that when they had looked at different models, they had also considered the Australian model. And this is the Australian model as they had it at, oh my goodness, the materials they provided their employees were incredible back in 2006. But they talked about commitment, management, and assurance, which I did as the three C's, commitment, culture, and control. But notice under management, management is provided by hardwiring the values into management practices. And that's where we picked up the terminology hardwiring and said, okay, values have to be a part of everything we do. They're not just how we treat our people. They're absolutely every part of our business should be considering the values in the organization. So then with the next slide, Departmental Audit Committee. On our Departmental Audit Committee, our very first one that we had within the federal public sector, Scott Serson was on our committee. Couldn't have had a better person, someone who truly got the importance of values and ethics and truly challenged us as an organization to say, what are you doing in the area of values and ethics within your organization? And notice the questions the audit committees were supposed to ask us as organizations, what are you doing with respect to this ongoing ethical dialogue? Now, my next two slides, I'm just going to be conscious of time. You can't read that slide, but you'll get a copy of the DAC. But I think I'll just pass over these. But this was this year's example of how we actually encouraged ethical dialogue on the hashtag MeToo scenario. This scenario is actually about sexual harassment in the workplace. We provided all managers, supervisors, executives with supporting documents so they could sit down with their employees and have a discussion on how would you handle this situation where you work. And it really elicited extremely good feedback from employees. But I'll skip there. That's the scenario. That's just a comment on how the process ran. But on the next slide, which will be my next to last slide, basically, this has become my favorite quote. It's a quote by Will Rogers. And basically, Will Rogers said, even if you're on the right track, you'll get run over if you just sit there. And I think that's what the next panel is going to talk to. But we're not just sitting there. And with the next slide, you will see we have a tremendous, tremendous community of practice of ethics practitioners in the federal public service. We sit down on a monthly basis. We're the Interdepartmental Network for Values and Ethics. There are a number of people who sit on that network in this room. And we decided what we would do. Now, it's a couple of years now. We sat down and we formed a small working group and we said, let's look at the Ralph Heinzman model with those five key drivers and how would we position it today. So we don't call them drivers, we've called them key elements. And note, we've gone from organizational culture to ethical organizational culture, from leadership to ethical leadership. Look up the definition of ethical leadership, it's not the same as leadership alone. And we added a piece, actually, with awareness and knowledge building. So on my last slide, we took those key elements And we basically defined what we meant by each of those key elements, what we the expected outcome would be, what we would suggest you do to demonstrate ethical leadership, ethical organizational culture, whatever, in your organization, making it broad enough because we recognize not all organizations are the same. So the elements were presented generally. They're not mutually exclusive, so sometimes the activities actually support more than one element, the activities we suggest. But the other thing we did was we created a four-level maturity model. We tried to squeeze out five levels, but we found level four and five were pretty similar. And basically what we said is, in each of those elements, if you're at level one, this is what you're doing within your organization with respect to each of those key elements. But if you're at level four, this is what you're doing. And you might be at different levels for different of the elements. And you'll note, we did talk about challenges, because this was our community writ large putting this together, and it provides guidance. But one of the things with the challenges is, you know, you might have difficulty convincing your deputy head that it's the right thing to do, right? But, you know, go for it. Because what we did was we went from our own experiences, we went from international best practice. Because there's so much information now out there about what constitutes an ethical organization and the kinds of activities it carries out. So I would suggest we're on the track. We're running down it. We're trying to keep ahead of the train. And maybe sometimes, you know, we've actually rounded the bend and we're ahead altogether. But we have not just sat there. We've actually discussed as a community what should we be doing to improve what we have at the federal level.
Thank you very much, Anne. So I'll introduce Ian just by maybe linking a couple of ideas again. We heard a lot about speaking truth to power today. My brother Andrew referred to sunlight being the best disinfectant. My words a little bit there. But I think also I'll hearken back again to something that Ms. Dawson brought forward. There is internal and external oversight within government. I say internal because that's going to be within the departments and agencies. External in the context of agents of parliament, the Office of the Auditor General being one of them. And I'll say from the perspective of audit teams, it's sometimes difficult to bring out tough messages. That is no more true than for whistleblowers, frankly. And when I think about the courage and intestinal fortitude that it takes to be a whistleblower, and we encounter them in the audit practice a lot. In many of the audits that I discussed earlier, there were whistleblowers that were trying to come forward at various points in time. They felt like they were banging their heads against the wall, or they felt like they were going to be the subject of retaliation. I think at this point, Ian might be able to provide some of the most poignant perspectives on that experience.
Thank you. So I'll tell you a little bit about myself. I started my life as an officer in the Navy, and I left in the early 90s before there was program review. There was a force reduction plan and program, and a lot of us took the chance to go out, and I went out into the world, but I ultimately ended up coming back into the public service in the early 2000s. And while I was there, I was working on the Marine security file, and I blew the whistle on what I thought was misconduct and unethical behaviors and nepotism. And it didn't turn out terribly well, I have to tell you. It was a bad experience. I fell between the cracks between the old public sector integrity officer and the new commissioner. And I was frankly flabbergasted at how easy it was for executives to make a reprisal against me. Like many whistleblowers, I went out and I tried to make sense of what had happened to me. I met other whistleblowers. We talked about what happened. We formed a group. I also became curious about institutional factors, because it didn't just seem to be people that were reacting against me. It seemed to be whole institutions. It seemed to be like what somebody called an instinctive or an antibody response. So I started studying it. And right now I'm doing my studies at Carleton University. My thesis is on institutional barriers to whistleblowing. I'd like to, but I've also stayed active with other whistleblowers. And we this group of whistleblowers and I, we try to counsel people who have issues, who feel they haven't been addressed through the public service or can't be addressed through the public service. Sometimes they come to us much too late. They'll come to us 2 years after they've blown the whistle, their careers are finished, and there's really not much we can do. The best situation you have is when somebody comes to you before they blow the whistle. Now, there are avenues in government now. There's the Public Sector Integrity Office. These are supposed to protect you, and of course every department also has an integrity official that's supposed to provide an avenue. But for whatever reason, sometimes people think that they can't rely on these mechanisms. It might be some cue or another that tells them maybe they should speak to somebody outside first. So I've had the opportunity, the privilege, I guess, and sometimes the burden of hearing some of these stories from people and what they've had to go through when the system hasn't worked for them. So this is a brief history or a brief summary of the presentation. And that, unfortunately, is the popular perception of what happens to whistleblowers. It isn't necessarily the case. I'll give a brief summary of what whistleblowing is, because there is, and I've come against it many times, some misperceptions of what whistleblowing is. A lot of people seem to think that if somebody comes to you with some personal grievance and tries to present that as a whistleblower, that's a whistleblower, or if they bring a false report forward, that's whistleblowing. It isn't. It has to be a legitimate issue. The academic definition is Michelli and Neer, they defined it in 1985, and that remains the gold standard in the academic community. There are disputes about aspects of it. Is it just internal whistleblowing? Is that whistleblowing, internal whistleblowing, or does it have to go external to be considered whistleblowing? Does there have to be reprisal or a possibility of reprisal for it to be considered whistleblowing? So there are these finer issues. Now, the operational definitions, which are usually in the legislation in whatever country you're dealing with or province, because most provinces have it now. BC just introduced some legislation. They tend to be narrower. So instead of, terms like illegal, immoral, or illegitimate, they can cover a wide range of things. But usually in for example, in Canada's Act, it's gross misconduct, or it's threats to public safety or the environment, that sort of thing. And there's also a tendency to force whistleblowers into channels. And that's sometimes a problem, because if a whistleblower can't trust those channels or doesn't feel they can trust the channel, then they might try another way. And one of the classic ways to strip a whistleblower of protection is to either argue that they aren't a whistleblower because they covered an area that's outside the definition, or they use an avenue that wasn't considered legitimate. So the typical whistleblower experience is this. And contrary to most perceptions, whistleblowers who go external don't just jump and go and do that. 98%, there was a fellow out of Australia, his name is A.J. Brown, and he's done a big study, Whistling Why They Work. There's also the Merit Systems Protection Board in the United States. They've done some studies as well about the number of whistleblowers who will go outside, and nearly all of them first try internal avenues, and usually several levels internally. And each time they don't meet success, they have to make a new decision. Do I go forward again? Do I try again? Sometimes there are reprisals. And if there are reprisals, sometimes that digs them in. And, you know, it's a common misperception. There are two common misperceptions that I see from whistleblowers. One is that if I just take this to the right level, somebody will do something about it. Not necessarily. The other one is it can't get any worse than this. I've seen these reprisals. Oh, they can't do more to me now. Wrong. They can. It can go to the point where you are blacklisted in an industry. I read a great quote in one book that said that the reprisal isn't over until a nuclear engineer is living in a walk-up apartment above a pizza parlor. So, to debunk the myth, first of all, most whistleblowers are neither saints nor malcontents. As a corollary to this, I'd like to say that everybody likes the other guy's whistleblower. Nobody likes their own whistleblower. So you have, Jeffrey Wigand is a good example of the tobacco industry whistleblower, and everybody thinks he's a great guy. But the truth is that most whistleblowers go through an experience. And you don't come out of it unaffected. You come out of it quite often quite damaged. I've dealt with whistleblowers who are so wrapped up in their story that they can no longer separate the reprisal from the original incident that they reported. And it can take hours and sometimes days to unravel the two. It's quite challenging. And they all end up with some sort of personal grudge. So if you're going to include motive, for example, which often comes in good faith whistleblowing, if you're going to introduce that motive into whistleblowing, it can often be a bar for people to get protection. Well, he had a grudge. It's a classic suggestion about people who blow the whistle. And there is no real whistleblowing personality. I've heard anecdotal stories about organizations that wanted to do tests so they could screen out whistleblowers. And the truth is there isn't anything, Are you likely to talk out? It's usually the situation that people find themselves in. So anybody in any organization could end up being a whistleblower if they happen to see repeated serious wrongdoing and the evidence is clear. The things that will deter them will be the things like they don't think anything's going to be done about it, the threat of reprisal, that kind of thing. And the organization, if they feel that it's going to be able to correct, and this sort of speaks to what kind of organization you want to build, right? If you want to have an organization that's going to promote internal whistleblowing or speak up culture, as was Anne's presentation, you mentioned that previously, then you have to have an environment where people can feel they talk about things. In fact, many whistleblowers don't even consider themselves whistleblowers. They'll be in an organization, they'll raise an issue, something will get done about it, and it's over. They're a whistleblower. You try to tell them that they're not a whistleblower or that they're a whistleblower, and they say, no. I met with Richard Colvin at a barbecue. I just bumped into him. And he says, I'm not a whistleblower. I was just doing my job. But I think most Canadians would define him as a whistleblower. And most whistleblowing does not result in reprisal. Again, these studies, the MTSB and the Whistling While They Work research suggested that only about 22% of people who blow the whistle face reprisal. Previous studies suggested higher numbers because the people who were in these studies were self-selected as whistleblowers and they'd been through the experience. I won't go through all these reasons. I think a speak-up culture is essential to a healthy organization. I think that's been found and it contributes to productivity. And I think that some of these points have already been spoken to by Anne. So the Tate Report on whistleblowing. So I had like everybody else, I went over it again and had to look at it during my studies. And I had to go out and dig into it and see what it said about whistleblowing. And there isn't a direct reference to whistleblowing per se, although I saw a couple of sources spoke to whistleblowing. And I thought, well, there's certainly the suggestion for an independent avenue to report unethical behavior. You could say that exists now both in Mary's former office and in the Public Sector Integrity Office. Whistleblowing may fit into the theme of speaking truth to power. Now, I think in the report it was framed more as senior public servants speaking truth to politicians because they're kind of the main point of contact. But what I thought was, well, junior employees in an organization, people several layers down, also need to be able to speak that truth to power, sometimes from people who don't want to people who don't want to hear it. But there were some mixed messages, and I don't think they were intentional mixed messages in the sense that you shouldn't blow the whistle or that whistleblowing is bad. It was more, okay, so there's loyalty to the crown and there's loyalty to the employer. And I've come across this in whistleblowing cases, both on the part of the whistleblower themselves. And the response, it's a very classic response, is to say, well, you're being disloyal to your employer. And this came up in, I don't know how many of you are familiar with the Fraser case way back when. And that was sort of hashed out in that decision, that you can be loyal to the employer and speak up. But it's confusing frequently to the working level employee about whether they can speak up and whether it's a legitimate use of their voice in speaking truth to power. It's particularly relevant because whistleblowing has often been attacked using ethical language. Back in the 70s, when it was relatively new and Ralph Nader first popularized the concept, there were CEOs of companies, for example, Ford, who basically branded whistleblowers as traitors to the company, destroying trust within the company, undermining teamwork. And this is the sort of reasoning has been undermined since, the Fraser decision being quite an important one. But also some theorists have pointed out, well, you know, your loyalty, it isn't to an individual in the organization. It's to the individual, it's to the values of the organization. It's to the public interest. And, you know, of course, it's to the minister. You know, that is presuming that the minister isn't himself involved in the wrongdoing. So the situation on the ground today, the ethics regime does appear to be in place, and the legal precedents exist, but has much changed. Since the Public Sector Integrity Office came into existence, there's been, I think, 16 reports made. That's over 12 years. Now, you can't say that the absence of evidence is the evidence of absence, for one thing. And it's hard to know whether there are a lot of other cases, because unlike in the United States, every so often they have these huge public service surveys, and they ask people specifically, have you seen wrongdoing in the last 2 years? Did you report it? Did you feel safe reporting it? That kind of question. I've never come across it in the public service. So that would offer some sort of measure, but that hasn't been done. From what we've seen, whistleblowers are still facing reprisals. One of the cases I'd like to present to you, and her case is kind of an interesting one because it's contested. Sylvie Therrien, she spoke out about the EI scandal, for example. She was the one, I don't know if you remember, there's a quota system in place for rejecting EI candidates. And basically what had happened is that the word had come on from on high, we want to cut the money that's spent on EI. So you have to meet a quota of $400,000 cut off over a year. And anybody with any training in ethics knows that this creates a massive moral hazard for the people involved, right? So you had managers whose bonuses are depending on people being punted off of the EI rolls, and then from there they have to fight their way through the appeal system, which had just been changed so that there was a backlog of at least 2 years going on. And in one case, Sylvie told me a case of this one fellow who was an Aboriginal, an indigenous person living on a reserve, and his case was rejected because he refused to move to find new work, which would be fine for most people, but he had treaty rights. And yet he was still kicked off and had to fight his way through. Where it's contentious is that it was said that, well, she's protesting a policy. She's not actually fighting, she's not protesting the wrongdoing in the way that, say, Alan Cutler did. You know, Alan Cutler refused to sign off on the sponsorship scandal contracts that were being done without any work performed. This is a policy, and a government policy isn't something that you can necessarily, you've got to implement it. It's like the Fraser case, you don't like the metric system, well, too bad for you. But where it was interesting, to me, where it did become important is because the way it was being operationalized from that policy was in ways that did violate the ethics code and did violate probably a law or two, and certainly the constitutional rights of that one Aboriginal fellow. So, yes, and as I said, so the cases that have been investigated by the Integrity Commissioner have all been relatively minor. They haven't involved anybody from above a director level. Nobody who has overseen the work of these people has faced any consequence. All right, so and institutional mechanisms and incentives still seem to favor the reprisal and the cover-up. In a responsive organization where people are responding upwards only and not necessarily downwards, it can be the incentive can be to just make the problem go away, and that doesn't help the whistleblower. And the courts in the PSLRB have not proven to be reliable to the people that I've dealt with. The courts have come down several times in favor of the whistleblower, but they've still been unable to get any protection. So from a whistleblower's perspective, you're asking yourself, is the fox guarding the hen house? Is this a case of the management runs the system that's supposed to protect us? Are they going to really protect us if it's not in their interest? And concluding with this slide, so what's the way forward? I think the Tate report is still very relevant. The problem has been that having the ethics framework isn't there. I think you spoke to it this morning, Ralph, about how, or maybe with other people as well, it becomes almost a pro forma exercise to go through the ethics. You take the training, you go back to your office, and you just do business as you've always done it. But there is a change happening, and I think younger people in particular are expecting more transparency and more to be done. And just think about whistleblower isn't considered the same way it used to be. It's a more positive term now. 20 years ago, it was the equivalent of snitch, you know. We need to change the incentives. And I also think where the Tate report really got it right was in leadership. Leadership, if you have leadership that is secure and is willing to accept some criticism without feeling that it's a failure and it reflects on them and to learn from it, then people will develop that speak up culture. And also, I guess, the third point here is that you have to remember that other people in the process can also get dragged into this whistleblowing thing. So you need to protect the people in HR who might say, well, maybe we shouldn't do this. Maybe we shouldn't make a reprisal. And I'll leave it there since I've run out of time.
Thank you very much, Ian. I guess we'll open it up to the floor, given that we have about 15 or so minutes. I have questions if there's not any from the floor, but I suspect that there will be a few.
Okay. Hi. I've got my notes here because I just want to pick up on a couple of quotes, which I think there's a theme in the notion of speaking truth to power. And Anne talked about employees should be willing to speak up. And of course, Ian, with your presentation on, you know, the experience of employees who have been speaking truth to power and what they've suffered as a result. And so my question, first of all, is to Andrew Trush, as a former deputy head. One of the things that I've been sort of thinking about a lot is that I come from the private sector originally, is what called the CEO's disease, where the deputy head or the CEO sees there's problems within his or her organization, but all of his or her executives are giving them good news. And that happens quite a lot. I've experienced it myself, where we're whitewashing messaging. We're not saying this pilot failed. Well, no, we can't tell the deputy head that. We can't tell the president that. So, I don't know if you've experienced that, and if so, what would be your thoughts on how do we break that? Because I think that, you know, as a senior ethics advisor, my job is to provide truth. It's to provide, you know, unbiased, objective, impartial information as I see it, as I gather it to the best of my understandings, so that upper management can make, you know, sound decisions on how to make things better.
Thanks. I think it's a legitimate concern for leaders in any organization, if you're only getting good news, then you should be really worried. There's something worried there. People are not speaking up. So a few things in the toolkit. One is, it's a remark about the public sector survey. You can use that to drill down. I have and have done that. Unless you get to incredibly small sales, like under five, but that's, I find that incredibly powerful tool. You get your organization's results, you compare it against the previous survey, you compare it against the public service average. Then you go within your organization, you compare each sector. Then you go in a sector and you go down to offices of 50 people. And if there's some red lights flashing there, some real deviations, you've got questions to ask. So that's one thing. Sadly, in government, bad news comes to you in the newspaper. Yeah. And while we're all, you know, busy writing our response lines and so forth, but, you know, let's face it, sometimes our these unfriendly critics have actually, you know, put their finger on a serious problem, and you've got to attend to it that way. It's the signals the leadership sends to, you know. So you have to go out and engage in active listening. The people that you promote, the people that you reward, have to be rewarded because they're modeling that kind of behavior. You know, that's something very important. In terms of the machinery as well, based on the last public sector survey, I read the harassment numbers. CRA was right there in the public service average. I wasn't happy with that. And there were sufficient questions that said people, there was a fear of reprisal. As well as I think there was a lot of confusion about where to go. So our internal integrity person, the vast majority of their complaints were classic HR matters. They didn't get the promotion, or you know, there were things that were fell within the realm of human resources and not those other deeper issues. So we chose to contract it out and then to publicize it. So people that felt, well, you know, really, that integrity officer, it's really still CRA. How do I know he's not whispering to the commissioner or someone? So we went to a private sector supplier that had a different postal address, a different office. It was outside the CRA. Now, I don't know. The next question would be to assess that, and did it make a difference? And I don't know the answer to that. It may have succeeded. It's an experiment. It may have not made a difference. So those are a few tools.
Thank you.
Robert Grévy, Indian Affairs. I have two questions, pretty different, although perhaps a little bit related. The first one is actually an idea I'd like to throw out for you, talking about whistleblowing, Mr. Brown, but also perhaps to other people, as it may be full, or it may help, I don't know, that's why I want to get some feedback. I find it very burdensome on the whistleblower, the system or the governance we have about wrongdoing. It takes an enormous amount of courage, I believe, for whistleblowers to go up. And basically the governance we have set up is to put one individual against an institution, if not the whole government. How is this fair? I mean, Goliath, most of the times, win out of the Bible, right? So why don't we put some balance in this game, asking institutions to ask every employees each year what kind of wrongdoing would you have noticed? And make sort of a survey administered by an external organization so that everybody can, you know, feel almost free to say the little things or the minor or the bigger or middle things they have noticed, and you know, the good report come out of that. So that's my first question. The second question is about understanding the support all seven servants could have in terms of speaking truth to power. And I'm not necessarily referring to wrongdoing here. It could be about policy making. But if we're saying that one of the function or the duty of the civil service is to say truth to power, what's our support? What's the legal support that gives civil servants legitimacy to say, hey, you bunch of senior managers, I really think you're going the wrong direction. It takes courage again. And we're talking reprisal, but not being promoted is also some sort of reprisal, right? So I'm wondering, is there in the in some act creating the public service some sort of legitimacy for the civil servants to speak truth to power? Is there in some article we can base our push or questions? Anyway, I hope I'm clear enough.
Well, for the idea of a survey, I think that's, yes, that would be a great idea. It's hard to measure how big the problem, or how to know how big the problem is without any measurement of it. Why one hasn't been done before, I don't know. It might be just a too big or too fraught a question to ask the public service. It might just be that, I can't answer why they haven't done that, but I think it would be a good idea. And as for whether there's anything that statutorily or regulation or policy about speaking truth to power, I think these are conventions of the Westminster government, and they're usually unwritten by definition. So I don't know if anybody has the Tate report certainly provide some substance to the reasoning why you would want that.
Yeah, if I could make a comment, it's interesting because speaking truth to power to me is just, you know, and someone said, the person who asked the question talked about having the courage to speak up, period, right? But basically it goes again, and I'm going to sound like a broken record, to creating a culture, the right ethical culture, where employees will speak up, and that includes speaking truth to power. Yeah. When you look at a lot of studies, the studies show you that the number one reason that employees don't speak up is because they don't actually think anything will get done. Like, why bother? I speak up to you. I mean, we get the public service employee surveys, and time after time after time, they can show the same issue, that employees don't believe we actually take care of poor performers, or they don't believe we deal with ethical issues. So we have to create the culture. And one thing our organization just did, and I have to give kudos to the president and EVP, because I don't think the president was overly keen on doing a video, but actually it was directly in response to the hashtag MeToo, and all, for those of you not aware, that the certainly a concern of the clerk, and he made sure that all his deputy ministers were aware, you know, guys, we have to, are all the systems in place? Have we got it set so employees will speak up? What our president and EVP did is they did a 2.5-minute video, and it was obvious that it wasn't their comfort zone being filmed. They weren't actors, but it was so genuine and so real. So we want to know. We want you to speak up. Speak Up, We're Listening has become our program. but we want you to speak up, that we will do something. We'll do the right thing. I mean, it's not, you know, we're not going to, we have to follow due process, but we will also be timely in it. But go, you know, speak up to someone you're comfortable speaking up to. Go to a colleague, go to a friend. There's all sorts of internal mechanisms, and we created a new phone line. And that phone line, it's the responsibility for it is in my office, has really been ringing off the hook. But it hasn't only caused people to call the phone line. I'm our integrity officer, by the way, in our organization, responsible for taking disclosures of wrongdoing. But I've had, and it only was at the end of March that we launched it, I've had more than a dozen calls now directly to me. And 95%+ of the people who call say to me, Anne, we saw the video, and we really believe the president and executive vice president mean what they say. They want us to speak up, so we're coming to you and we're speaking up. You have to set the tone at the top. You have to walk the talk. You have to have the right culture. And the thing is, that's if the top shows that we really mean it, speak up, we'll protect you from reprisal, absolutely not acceptable in an organization, etc. But it really is the culture that we have to change.
Just briefly, I think it's a good idea. I think you first made it in your remarks to include a question in the public sector survey. My only is it would be important to define wrongdoing, give it some definition. For many public servants, downsizing or lack of investment in their program would probably be seen as wrongdoing. So I think we'd want to work that part through, but it would be helpful to have that question. Any leader, truth to power is as useful a concept for the deputy in looking down into his organization as it is to serving your minister. And a deputy who is not encouraging, candid, and honest, and thorough discussion among his managers with his employees is not doing the job that's asked of him or her. You don't want an organization of yes minister or yes deputy. It's death. You know, I trained under those hard-headed finance guys, and when they had a discussion with the minister, there was swearing in the room. There were vicious disagreements, but the discussion was well had. And then there's loyal implementation. The two actually are both part of the public service pact, because we're not the minister. And when we've offered our best advice and we've made our best arguments, the decision may well not go the way that we personally would prefer. But if it's lawful and there's due process, then we implement it. And that is hard for some of us.
One more question, Jesse.
Okay. Hi, it's a question for you, Ian. I just want to pick up on something you mentioned. One of the things our office looks after is disclosures of wrongdoing, and I work to support disclosures through the process. And I've seen cases where things can take so long because of the volume of work and the, you know, due process, where at the end you can have a discloser who's, you know, so frustrated and impacted in terms of stress and so on that it can turn into a performance issue. And then you've got management, you know, and that risk of reprisal for them. You'd mentioned when you spoke earlier that you have the opportunity to speak to disclosers. And I know that there's the organization FAIR. I haven't checked into anything they've done recently, but I'm wondering, is this just through your network, or is there an informal group where that can offer some kind of support outside of the organization for individuals who, you know, I'm dealing with one person who's just won't see a counselor, won't see ICMS, or the mediators, just zero trust in anyone except me in the organization, and needs, you know, like an outlet like that to share experiences would be, you know, an additional support. So I was just wondering what that involved.
There is. This is a group we call ourselves right now, Canadians for Accountability. It's being rebranded at present. That's kind of the thing we do. We offer some advice for people. it's always better if they can come to us before they blow the whistle. And you're absolutely right. People who go through the process stop trusting anybody. And I think it's really important for people in that position to speak to like-minded people who, so they don't think they're crazy, because that's one of the classic things that, that whistleblowers will feel. So, am I crazy? Am I the only one that sees this? And, you know, just to have that kind of support will make them feel a lot better. Because one of the worst things, too, is being isolated, right? You know, if you, all too often being a whistleblower means being ostracized, being left out of meetings, work restrictions. So, yeah, it's good for the mental health of people, too.
Thank you. It's 25-2, and I think that we can do with just a 20-minute break and get back for three. So, Andrew Hayes has a question.
So just fair warning, Ann, this one's kind of coming to you. Jim Mitchell at the beginning of the day referred to the Tate Report as a biblical text that provides guidance that remains. I'm wondering, from your perspective, and do you see that the very same way operating in the current times with the realities that have happened over the last 20 years?
I would suggest yes. It's interesting referring to it like a biblical text, because if something is right, I think it remains right. I think the Tate Report, I've heard it time and time again today, and to me, the Tate Report, there may be elements of it which are showing its age, but the Tate Report is as relevant today as it was when it was drafted 20 years ago. And the diagram that I showed that Mr. Heintzman had developed that came out of the Tate Report is as relevant today. Yeah, we updated it somewhat over the past couple of years, but I see them as relevant. There's some basic principles to how values and ethics programs look that don't change. And when I hear people say, well, the younger generation coming in, the different, you know, how we communicate differently, all of that, there are some basic underpinnings that won't change. So I see the Tate Report as still relevant. I don't know how else to put it, but it's like when someone said to me once, certain things we say in our code of conduct as to how you represent yourself outside the organization. And our code of conduct was drafted before you had all sorts of social media and that connection to Twitter, the whole nine yards. And basically, someone was asking if what someone did on their social media was inappropriate. And even though social media per se wasn't covered in the code at the time, the rule was still the same. It doesn't matter whether you're having a conversation in a coffee shop or you're having it on social media or Twitter. The basic rule was still the same, right? Sure, the mode changed, the medium that you use changed, but the basic principle was the same.
Well, it must be biblical. it is the Tate Conference. But I do think these are different times, and they do present new challenges. And the answers are not all there. It's not a book you can just go to and say, I have this problem. Oh, thank God, there it is, page 33, third paragraph. Nor for that matter, does the Act or the Code. And I think part of that relates to the mandate of your organization. The Canada Revenue Agency has some specific issues as a tax administration. The rest of you don't need to worry about those. Public Works had issues given its role in real property and procurement. It has to deal with those in much greater depth than many of you need to worry about. So some of them relate to our mandates. And I did argue in my remarks that we have new issues to worry about that just weren't there in 1996. But that's not devaluing Tate. And it's why he called for constant dialogue and honest discussion, because he himself, if he were here, would have seen that that was the ultimate best recourse rather than something written down 20 years ago. That's all.
Thank you very much to our panel. Thank you, Anne, for working with the arrangements here. And I think this is a perfect segue to when we return in 20 minutes to look at the new challenges and perhaps also a challenge that's a very ancient one. So we'll start again at 3 o'clock. Thank you. Yeah.